my government spending. Oh, this is nasty.
This country and the modern American middle class, which is what made this country, and to the extent that America has enjoyed a post-World War II largesse, it's because of the creation of the middle class, both as a producing and consuming entity. The American middle class, I mean, the Donna Reed Show America that most of us know and remember, was created by government spending. Specifically, the middle class going into World War II was relatively small. But the combination of the GI Bill, which made a college education accessible to all of the GIs returning from World War II, and there had been conscription, remember, in World War II, and the Veterans Home Loan Program, which made the ownership of one's own home affordable to these very same people who had made the jump from the working class, or actually poverty, into the middle and upper middle classes. That was produced by government spending. The GI Bill, which made college education affordable to large numbers of returning GIs. And then, in addition to that, the Veterans Home Loan Program made it relatively affordable for them to own their own houses. And a combination of the GI Bill and the Veterans Home Loan Program, both of them government spending programs that we're hearing so much about how we can't have them, created this country as most of us have come to understand it. You know, it's really obscene to contemplate, you know, we can't got to hold down government spending. Yeah, unless we're, you know, going to spend it all on some ridiculous weapons program. In the late 1980s, one year I owed the IRS $1,400. I sent them a letter asking if they'd take two hammers and a toilet seat in payment. They didn't appreciate that. That's the only time I ever got audited, and I must say I deserved it, you know. That was definitely, I didn't even go long form, you know, I just did a little straight, you know, short form. They were all over me, though, and they didn't like that one bit. But, you know, we got to hold down government spending. There have been some really good columns in the New York Times lately, and also they've been carried by some of the Bay Area papers. Some of the New York Times and op-ed writers are getting really scared by what's going on in this country. In particular, the Republican Congress is just absolutely, I think that Gingrich and company, their real loyalty is to the underground Reich. And I think if you go into some of those political action committees that funded the Gingrich operation, I think you'll find that that's Bormann money that's going in there. Because Gingrich himself was going to high school in a military high school in Germany in a period in which a major focal point of international fascist recruiting was to recruit not only American servicemen and their family, but basically to recruit American servicemen and also members of their families who were serving in Europe at that time. And Gingrich was serving at that time. He wrote a really interesting book called 1945, in which Otto Skorzeny comes to the United States to try to knock out America's nuclear capability, which was, you know, half right. I mean, he did go to work for the CIA, and he has visited the United States. He just didn't try to knock out our nuclear capability. And his political action plan is based on the operational paradigm of the Wehrmacht. In other words, his paradigm for political activity is based on the operational paradigm of the Wehrmacht, you know, the German army. And I got a lot of questions about Gingrich and company, but the way in which they're behaving is so, it not only is not healthy for the United States, it is so anti-American, it's subversive. I mean, they're holding up funds for the International Monetary Fund, which might produce a collapse in the Asian markets. They're holding up all kinds of money. They're just anything Clinton endorses, they're going to oppose. I mean, the Republican Party is a subversive political party. It is fascist. I mean, it falls to the right of Mussolini. You know, it is a really wicked institution, and I really get impatient with the people picking the so-called, what I always term the so-called progressive sector. We're always talking about how there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. And as I've said many times, and I'm sure many of you have heard me say this at various talks, there is a big difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. There's not as much difference as there should be. There's not as much difference as I personally would like to see, but there's a big difference. There's no Nazi branch of the Democratic Party. You know, they don't have a Nazi branch of the party rooted in the Third Reich, and the damn Republican Party does. I mean, this is a direct, the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council is a direct outgrowth of the Third Reich. I mean, it is absolutely an outrageous institution, and it is a prominent element of the Republican Party. The person who selected all of the lists from which Ronald Reagan made his appointments when he became president of the United States was a woman named Helena von Dahn. And she was the protege of Otto von Bolschwing. Von Bolschwing was a key Sicherheitsdienst agent. He was Adolf Eichmann's superior. Eichmann ran the Final Solution, you know, the liquidation of the Jews. Eichmann was a key SD official involved with stimulating the Iron Guard revolt that brought fascism to Romania. He then set up a parallel organization to Reinhard Gehlen's in the United States. And one of his proteges was Helena von Dahn. She eventually became U.S. ambassador to Austria. She kept the name of her second husband. She married a member of William Clark's military intelligence unit in Europe. A very common intelligence methodology is to have, if you want to get somebody from one country to another, you have them effect a marriage, and then they marry a national of the country they want to infiltrate. Then they get divorced as soon as the person is established in that country. It appears that that's what happened with Helena von Dahn. She married a member of the same military intelligence unit that William Clark was a member of. William Clark was Ronald Reagan's second national security advisor, replacing Richard Allen. Then I believe William Clark himself, I think, is married to Werner von Braun's daughter. Von Braun, the Nazi rocket expert, was also an SS officer. A lot of people don't know that. When you think about Helena von Dahn, here is this woman who was a protege of one of the main architects of Hitler's liquidation of the Jews, and one of his political proteges drew up the lists from which Ronald Reagan made all of his appointments when he became president of the United States. She became special White House executive for presidential personnel. She kept the name, however, von Dahn is the name of her second husband, Christian von Dahn, who the last anybody heard was in charge of the Bank of America's branch in La Paz, Bolivia in 1982. Three guesses what kinds of profits they were running in and out of La Paz, Bolivia in the early 1980s. You know, the first two guesses don't count. This was the period in which the cocaine coup and the people who, you know, Klaus Barbie and the Coca Fascisti were going great guns. And that in all probability is why Helena von Dahn kept his name. It's a great business, the cocaine trade. You know, she was proud of it, I'm sure. But the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, there's not as much difference as there should be. The Democrats have largely prostituted themselves to the corporations. But as I've said before, The difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is like being asked, which would you like for dinner, a slab of salt pork or a pile of fresh horse manure? It's not a very appetizing choice, but it's a very clear one, you know, very, very clear indeed. The Republicans being the horse manure and the Democrats the salt pork under the circumstances, you know. It's like, you know, Clinton is no day at the beach. On the other hand, as much of a whore as he is, and he is in a lot of ways, at the same time, you know, you look at all the people that are dropping dead around him. You look at all of the presidential aircraft that have crashed right after either Clinton and or Hillary and Chelsea have been in it. You look at all the people who've died. Two key campaign aides died when he was running in 92. A woman who was signing his speeches for the hearing impaired dropped dead of alleged natural causes at the age of 32 right before the inauguration. The four ATF, this is one thing from the right wing that's true. The ATF, four ATF agents who died at the Waco assault were all bodyguards for Bill Clinton. Then you have Vince Foster dying. Admiral Borda, his chief of naval operations, another alleged suicide, shoots himself in the chest. You know, not very likely Ron Brown buys it in Croatia under strained circumstances. A fellow named Thomas Friedman, who was Clinton's special envoy to Rwanda, was found dead, floating dead in a canal in the Potomac River. They said he was running by the side of the river and he slipped in and fell. You know, tough luck, you know. So who knows what kinds of messages are being delivered to Bill behind the scenes, you know, saying, okay, well, you know, we've got Tom Friedman, you know, we've got Ron Brown, you know, we can get Hillary, we'll get your wife, we'll get your daughter, you know, get anybody you want, you know, you're going to do what we want. And so the Clintons themselves are tainted to an extent. Well, Hillary did some legal work on for the Watergate committee. She helped to limit the Watergate investigation. But if you're going to move up into the system, you're basically going to have to play ball. You're going to have to network with these various people. And so I'm not as judgmental about Clinton as a lot of people. It's easy, you know, the old Native American expression that you should not judge a man until you walked a mile in his moccasins. And you know, I would not want to walk a mile in Bill Clinton's moccasins. It's real easy to say, well, you know, he didn't do this and he should have done this. And I'm certainly disappointed in him. On the other hand, you cannot view Bill Clinton except as part of a historical continuum, which includes the systematic murder of every moderate and progressive political leader we've had in the last 30 years. And yet, we as a people remain blissfully unaware, or at least seemingly unaware, of the fact that political assassination has become an established way of life in the United States. Mort Saul, who, by the way, the political comedian Some of you may know of him. He pretty much ran Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans. He later managed Jim Garrison's reelection campaign as DA. He wrote the summation to the jury, by the way. How many of you have seen the movie JFK? Well, the summation to the jury was relayed virtually verbatim. That was the summation of the jury that Garrison gave. And it was written by Morth Saul, who was not only a speechwriter for Kennedy, later wrote for Ronald Reagan, among others. But in his 1976 autobiography, Heartland, Morth Saul wrote, "How many people are going to have to die before Americans realize that murder is not an established way of life, is not a way of life? You know, is it too late for America?" And that's a very, very interesting concept to ponder. He also had a very interesting metaphor about America as a woman. And he said, basically, the problem with Americans is that they bring her, referring to the United States as a woman, they bring her only their lust, but they cannot love her, which is an interesting metaphor. And I think it's really very true. You know, they come with lust, but not love. I think the bottom line is this country is the way it is because that's the way the people who live in it have made it. And it's important to understand that because you're one of the people living in it. And you may not be able to have a pivotal effect by yourself. I mean, you're not a senior partner with Sullivan and Cromwell or Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn. You're not likely to wind up working for the Bank for International Settlements. And you're not likely to wind up in it, you know, the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in the 1930s, not unless you can master some sort of Star Trek-like time warp. But the point being that you can have an effect, albeit not a pivotal one, not as profound an effect as these individuals have. But in the information age, the ability of an individual to acquire and collate and communicate information has never been greater. If there's anything I find as a cause for optimism, that's it, is that our ability to gather information has never been greater. And with things like the Internet, granted it's monitored, with things like talk shows, granted the deck is stacked there, it's possible to get information out, you know. And the cassette recorder is a marvelous thing. And I didn't realize until a few years ago that how appropriate it is for me to be doing these tapes and doing radio shows for people to tape and then encouraging people to copy tapes and running tape duplication services, because magnetic tape was actually developed by I.G. Farben in World War II, and it was specifically developed, to help spies transmit messages at very high speed over the airwaves. What they would do was they would take a message and they would run it at very, very high speed over the short wave of the radio so that it would sound just like, it would sound like just a little bit of interference, a little bit of static, but when it was recorded and then slowed down, they could communicate the message. And this was the first operational use for magnetic tape. It was a device to permit spies to conduct clandestine communication. So in a way, it's very appropriate that I should be, you know, making these tapes and utilizing electromagnetic tape in a democratic and counterintelligence capability. It's sort of, I guess, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, or perhaps it's the law of karma as applied to espionage and magnetic tape. Who knows? It's sort of appropriate. Questions and comments? Yes, sir. Orlando Bosch and who?
Jorge Mascanosa.
That last name I'm not familiar with. Oh, okay. Well, I think in terms of the anti-Castro Cuban community, I think it's more or less business as usual, as near as anybody's been able to tell. Orlando Bosch was head of the CORU organization, which was an extremely reactionary, even for anti-Castro Cubans organization, that in turn became part of the Fascist International, as Henrik Krüger has described it. One of the best books about not only the intelligence community, but also about international fascism and the narcotics trade was The Great Heroin Coup, authored by freelance Danish journalist Henrik Krüger, last name K-R-U-G-E-R. This was a mainstay of the program in the early and mid-1980s. Veteran listeners of the program will be very familiar with that name. It's funny because for all of the publicity about the intelligence community and their involvement with the narcotics trade, they have not gone beyond what Henrik Krüger came out with in 1980, and he directly foreshadowed much of the Iran-Contra scandal. He talked about the role of people like Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, who figured in that very prominently. And he talked about the Miami connection and their connections with Latin American death squads and so on and so forth. Orlando Bosch was one of the major elements in Coru and the Internationale Fascista, literally part of a fascist international, which embraces in its North American branch people like Orlando Bosch and the Coru, that's C-O-R-U organization, and then also Latin American fascists and Spanish and Italian fascists as well. Much of the old Skorzenian Borghese network. Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese was a key Italian fascist and a World War II associate of Otto Skorzeny. And the Coru organization was a Cuban, U.S.-sponsored fascist intelligence group. It's interesting that the... Well, first, let me talk a little bit about Latin fascism. When Franco came to power in Spain, he was a fascist dictator supported by Hitler and Mussolini. He established his fascist organization, the Falange, F-A-L-A-N-G-E, as an international organization. And the Falange established branches in many other countries that had been imperial properties of Spain when Spain was an empire. Latin America, the Philippines, and other places, they all had branches of the Falange, again, the Spanish fascist party under Franco. The most important and most virulent of the Falange branches in the Americas was the Cuban branch. And when Castro overthrew Batista, three guesses where that branch moved to. Miami, Florida, basically, that the southern rim of the United States. It's interesting, when you drink San Miguel beer, you may go to a liquor store sometime drinking San Miguel beer, the entire alcoholic beverages industry is fascistic. Whenever I drink an American beer, which is very seldom, I always drink Coors for a very simple reason. It's the only... A beer is an unregulated industry. They can put any bloody thing they want in there, and they do. Coors is the only American beer that's additive-free. It's the reason I drink it. Of course, the Coors are a bunch of raving fascists. It's absolutely true. But so are all the rest of them. The Bush family were members of the German-American Bund. But the Soriano family, Andres and Miguel Soriano, when you have San Miguel beer... It's owned by the Soriano family, and the Soriano family were the main Falange operatives in the Philippines. When MacArthur landed in the Philippines, he promptly appointed Andres Soriano as one of his top economic aides in the Philippines. His G2 officer was Charles Willoughby, nee Carl Adolf von Chepel in Wiedenbach, who was a German-born fascist, educated at the Kriegswehr Academy, and he oversaw all intelligence for MacArthur from 1939 through 1950. That's one of the reasons why MacArthur was busy excluding all the OSS people in the Pacific Theater, because he still hated Bill Donovan's guts from World War I when Bill Donovan frustrated his great trap by having the Fighting 69th hold their position. They got wiped out. I mean, poor Fighting 69th. I mean, there was a whole bunch of them when they trooped out for World War I. They almost all were killed. They had this big victory parade marching down Wall Street. You know, two-thirds of them were dead. I mean, the Fighting 69th belonged pretty much to the ages at that point, because they're almost all dead. But it's interesting to watch the Falange as it evolved through history. In my opinion, I think we could view Orlando Bosch and Coru as pretty much the ontogenetic successors to the Falange. There may, in fact, have been some operational connections. I don't know. They certainly, Coru worked with many of the international fascist elements with which the Falange had been associated, largely Otto Skorzeny and his Odessa milieu operating out of Madrid. So as far as what they're doing today, Radio Marti continues to broadcast to Cuba, and I think it's pretty much business as usual. I haven't seen any particular indications of a sea change in U.S. intelligence policy towards Cuba. Orlando Bosch was?
Yeah.
George Bush, by the way, saw to it that Orlando Bosch was handled with kid gloves. And Orlando Bosch was involved with a blowing up of a Cuban airliner in 1976. And another fellow, Roman Posada Carriles, who was a main operative for the Contra supply effort out of Ilopango Air Base for Oliver North and Company, was also involved with that same operation. What we saw with the Iran-Contra was, to a large extent, the Contra support network was a revival of many of these fascist, not I shouldn't say revival, but a utilization, because they never disappeared, but a utilization of many of these same fascist networks, and many of the worst operatives from the Coru people turned up in connection with these types of activities. Yes, gentleman in the very, very back. As far as I know, yes, she's on, I believe she is. Yes, Mary Farrell is a Texas-based JFK assassination researcher. I believe she still is, yes. As far as I know, yeah, I mean, I think Penn Jones' work, Penn Jones is was one of the earlier the JFK assassination researchers. His work is excellent. I think his Forgive My Grief series is just fine. And sadly, it's largely overlooked. I mean, you don't hear about him, and he was not one of those who leapt up on the stage in the wake of the Oliver Stone film to try and snag glory. But his work is excellent and sadly and largely overlooked, in my opinion. But he is still alive, and I believe Mary Farrell is very much alive, too. Sure. Marshall who? I've never heard of him. In what context did you... Name is not ringing any bells for me, so I'm afraid I can't help you out. Yes, Mark?
Yeah, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, in the supermarket, mm-hmm.
Where did you see this?
Just one of these tabloids. I
yeah.
called the Star. But, I personally feel that it's getting close to the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be, maybe they'll break out some, new computer-enhanced thing of the Zapruder film or some secrets are going to be let loose that will either lay the groundwork or the tracks to, Russia and Cuba.
This was part of the maneuvering in the wake of the JFK assassination. In fact, one of the many reasons Kennedy was killed was that he was in the process of working out a diplomatic rapprochement with Cuba. Castro, like Ho Chi Minh, although a communist, was primarily a Cuban nationalist. And he understood, being an intelligent fellow, he understood that it was in Cuba's best long-term interest to have a good relationship with El Norte, the giant to its north. And Kennedy, in turn, being a realist, was prepared. They're working out a diplomatic rapprochement. A French journalist named Jean Daniel was actually meeting with Castro as a representative of this back-channel diplomatic maneuver when Castro heard Kennedy was killed. And what they were going to do was that Kennedy was going to take responsibility for the Batista dictatorship on behalf of the United States. In return, Castro was going to move away from the international communists in his own milieu, including and especially Che Guevara, and he was going to move away from the Soviet Union and become more of a truly non-aligned country. This was not to be, obviously, but in fact, the day Castro, by the way, has confirmed this, as well as Kennedy administration State Department officials, Jean Daniel has confirmed this. And again, as I said, when Castro heard Kennedy was killed, he was actually meeting with Jean Daniel to do this. And that's one of many reasons why Kennedy was killed, because it's almost certain that the intelligence community had found out about this. In fact, it's been all but established that they did. It's also worth noting a bit of an aside in that regard. Among the many pieces of disinformation that was floated by General Oberst and Waffen-SS Noam Chomsky in the wake of the JFK movie, Noam Chomsky sort of walked point for the so-called progressive sector in dissing the notion that A, Kennedy was pulling us out of Vietnam, which he was, B, that he was doing anything else that was halfway decent. The Noam Chomsky version of history is run something like this. John F. Kennedy started World War I. John F. Kennedy started World War II. John F. Kennedy started the Korean War. John F. Kennedy started the Vietnam War. John F. Kennedy started the Persian Gulf War, even though he'd already been dead for 28 years. And if there's another war, John F. Kennedy will have started that, too. I mean, Chomsky is not only a charlatan, but an intelligence community finance charlatan and a very disreputable individual. And yet he is held as a deity by the so-called progressive sector. He literally walked point for the so-called progressive sector in the wake of the JFK film, dissing virtually everything that began to emerge, correctly so. And he has walked point for the so-called progressives in attempting to refute the notion that there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination. This despite the fact that by his own admission, he's never studied the Kennedy assassination. Yet he says that it's obvious there was no conspiracy, even though he's never studied it. But one of the things he has poo-pooed is the notion that Kennedy was achieving a rapprochement with Castro. Well, What would Fidel Castro and Kennedy administration diplomats and Jean Daniel himself know about it compared with a guiding light like Noam Chomsky? It's one of the methodological shortcomings that I find so glaring in our political scientific culture that we have these people who interpret things for us. And it's just as bad with the so-called progressive forces or left or liberal. I mean, we have this handful of people who interprets and shapes reality for us. And that's one of the reasons why we don't understand what's going on. And as I said, I was schmoozing with some of you outside during the break. One of the reasons why the information that I present has the impact that it does, it doesn't have anything to do with me, and I'm not being falsely modest, is that the truth itself has a power. Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, referred to his methodology as truth force, it's satyagraha. When you hear the truth, it has a power to it, and you can feel it, and it's very powerful. And that is a lot of the impact that my program has. It's not that I'm, you know, that great or anything else, but most people have been lied to, and I've devoted a lot of time to ferreting out the facts. And when you take the time to put the facts together, I mean, we're not told what the CIA is. You know, we're handed sensational versions, you know, or, you know, Sylvester Stallone acting as, you know, CIA assassin and, you know, jumping out of an airplane from 1,500 feet up and landing on his feet and then making love to Sharon Stone right afterward. I mean, just, you know, these crazy, stupid things. So we don't know what the CIA is or where it comes from or why it does what it does or who was involved with setting it up. And yet when you begin to study how things have come to pass in this century, it's a relatively small number of institutions and a relatively small number of people, and the relationships between these things are really pretty readily comprehensible if, and it's a big if we're given the facts. And one of the major disinformation elements from the so-called left is Noam Chomsky, who is a sort of like, he's kind of like a pope or like an archbishop. He's there to intercede between us and God and to hand down to the poor supplicants on their knees just what the truth is. You know, the truth according to Pope Chomsky. But it's a very sad state of affairs. And so as far as are we going to see a resurgence of that, it wouldn't be surprising. I mean, in the wake of the Seymour Hersh book and with all this nasty shit about Kennedy, and Kennedy was in office, I guess he took office on January 20th of 61 and was killed not quite 3 years later. You look at all the things he either did or tried to do. He was pulling us out of Vietnam. He was trying to normalize relations with Castro's Cuba. In 1963, there were three CIA-administered coups in Latin America. Kennedy refused to recognize any of those governments because of that. People don't know about that. He negotiated the first substantive arms limitation agreement with the Soviet Union, the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty. Established Medicare, that's a Kennedy institution. The Civil Rights Bill of 1964 was a Kennedy, which pretty much was the Civil Rights Bill in the United States, was a Kennedy bill. It didn't get passed till after his death because it was obstructed. So many other things. I mean, he really did a lot and attempted to do a lot. And he was basically come to the conclusion the Cold War was extremely destructive and it was going to ruin the world if it didn't actually end the world. And he was trying to, he and Nikita Khrushchev were trying to end the Cold War. Both of them, by the way, combat veterans of World War II. I mean, these guys knew what it was like to be shot at. And it wasn't like some of the people we've had, Ronald Reagan, who made movies, for God's sake, and George Bush, who, you know, tail gunner George. But it's a nasty pun there. But it is sad to see what's being done to Kennedy's reputation. I mean, it's also interesting, too, one of the things I find really grotesque about the post-mortem assassination of Kennedy's reputation, now they've killed his body, now they're trying to kill his reputation. But all the stuff about Kennedy the womanizer, you know, all this stuff, I'm amazed that there have not been more protests or any protests from the feminist community. One of the things that underlies that whole notion is an incredibly antiquated and puritanical and extremely misogynist view of women. The notion is basically the old puritanical view of Cotton Mather, who's stalking the streets after midnight looking for fornicators. I mean, it's the notion that women are dirty and bad, and that if there's a man who enjoys being with them and making love to them, this is somehow sinful or bad. This is not to advocate that people play around in their wives. But this whole thing about Kennedy the womanizer is an extremely misogynistic and puritanical beauty, and women are dirty, and that men who have sex with women or who like to be around women and enjoy their sexual favors are dirty necessarily. This is not to say a man should take sexual advantage of a woman or anything else. In Europe, that's seen as a sign of good health. You know, they say, okay, our head of state is in good shape. You know, he still likes to boink, you know. And it's not viewed as any big deal. But we are so fucked up in our attitude towards sexuality that we view that as, you know, ew, ick, you know, ew, the nasty Kennedy, ew, he want to do what? Ew. You know, it's really sick. And I think that among the many shortcomings, it'd be nice to see some American women step forward and say, hey, listen, you know, referring to a man who is sexually active with women as a womanizer is really a very misogynistic and male chauvinist. And I wouldn't say male chauvinist necessarily. It's really misogynistic. It's very anti-female and views women as dirty and evil, you know, and it's one of the more disgusting things. Plus, Jackie was not exactly an angel herself. I mean, she was, you know, stepping out with Aristotle Onassis, among others, while Kennedy was still married to her. You know, they didn't really mind. You know, it was powerful people do that. You know, people in the elite do those, so they have affairs, and it's not exactly a major transgression. Jackie was doing the same thing. They both knew it, and, you know, it was just taken. This is what powerful people do, you know. Jackie was very aware of Kennedy's affairs, and she also was aware of her own situation, and she knew exactly where, you know, under whose bed JFK put his shoes every night, too, you know. And so that's one of the things that I find really disgusting. And some of the things that go on behind the scenes with regard to sexuality. There's a very credible account, for example, in a book called The Franklin Cover-Up, which originally began with the investigation of a failed savings and loan in Nebraska and eventually branched out. And it came across a homosexual pedophile ring, a national security-connected homosexual pedophile ring, in which the main name was George Bush. Basically, there was some very powerfully connected pedophile rings in which young guys, you know, 12, 14 years old, were being subjected to the sexual favors of old and powerful individuals. And the main individual was George Bush, the most poorly kept secret in official Washington. None of that George Bush is, I can't use the word gay. I mean, I still think of that as, you know, joyous or celebratory. And there's nothing, you know, George Bush was homosexual. One of the most poorly kept secrets in Washington. He also, you know, could sire a child. I guess he closed his eyes and thought about when he was with Barbara, he thought about a 12 or 13-year-old guy and just went down. But one of the most poorly kept secrets in all of official Washington, basically, is that George Bush packs fudge big time. And this has been known for a long time. I'm not at all judgmental about that myself. I could care less. People's genitals are their own, and I don't worry about them. But for this huge Republican, Christian, right-wing thing about how we can't do this, you know, we can't have an openly gay ambassador to, what is it, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg. This guy Hormel, the heir to the Hormel meatpacking fortune. He's no pun intended. That was not intended. But he's Clinton's first openly gay, the first openly gay ambassadorial post, and Republicans are freaking out. But George Bush, it was common knowledge in official Washington that George Bush was not only a homosexual, but he was what is known in gay circles as a chicken hawk. He liked young guys. When Bush first got elected, there was this whole thing about the wimp factor. That was what that was all about. Some of the old line Republican Guard knew about George and they didn't like the idea. It got fairly close to the surface at one point. Oliphant, the editorial cartoonist of the Washington Post, had this great cartoon. It was featured in the Chronicle. I guess it was a Mercury ran it, but it showed a bunch of women dressed and coiffed like Barbara Bush with a sort of plain, you know, polka dot dress and the hairstyle that way. They're all identical. One of them was very obviously George Bush in full drag with a long nose and glasses and knobby knees and hairy legs. And one woman is looking very disapprovingly to another and saying, personally, I like the Bush style, but I think it looks much better on Barbara. And this was when the Washington Post runs that as an editorial cartoon. That's as close to the surface as you're ever going to get. One of the things that's funny is in ultra-right-wing circles that there appears to be a larger-than-normal incidence of homosexuality. And this is in no way to be judgmental or moralistic, but it rather, I think, those who are very judgmental and moralistic, the Republican Party and the Christian right, should take a very good look. There was one of the guys who was a major hitman for the Republican right and who wrote a book called The Seduction of Hillary Clinton, was castigated by the right wing because it was not hard enough on Hillary. Like, one of the things it pointed out is that Hillary made a total of $20. She'd make $20 a month for her Whitewater law work. I mean, you gods, you know, that isn't even lunch money for a student at Foothill College. It's nothing. But a whopping $240 a year. But he wrote this book, and it was not nearly as unkind to Hillary as the right wing wanted, so they began attacking him. And one of the things they attacked him for was the fact that he was gay. And he then wrote another column saying that the Republican Party and Newt Gingrich, basically within the Gingrich Congress, is this homosexual mafia that are pretty much running things. There's also similar accounts coming out of the Institute for Historical Review right now. The No Holocaust, the Holocaust denying institution is being run by this right-wing gay clique. You know, and again, this is not in any way to pass judgment on gay people or any sort of sexual activity. I mean, I'm not talking about child molestation or something like that, but rather, it's interesting to see the people who are the most moralistic and have the most to hide. A classic example of those who are very much with sin casting the first stone. Not offhand. Not offhand. Not offhand. No, it's new. It's new to me. Anybody else? Questions? Yes, sir. I was going to say, did they star Jimmy Cagney in that? Yep. I think the situation in the former Soviet Union is, by its very nature, dangerous. I mean, you have that when you have that much weaponry and that kind of power in as unstable a situation as it is. It is dangerous. Now, I don't think the two situations are precisely analogous, simply because we don't have the ongoing corporate connections that existed in that transatlantic axis that I was talking about. Pretty much from the time of the Versailles Treaty, when you had people like John Foster Dulles networking with people like Hjalmar Schacht, when this group of elitists were already planning on rebuilding German industry as a mainspring of anti-communism in Europe, there are not these obviously ongoing corporate connections, because there were not the corporate connections to Soviet industry and finance. The Soviet Union, I think, is a somewhat different situation, although they're certainly obviously... When one form of government collapses, the people who existed under that form of government don't just evaporate. I don't think the two situations are exactly comparable, which is not to say that this not only might be dangerous, but might be more dangerous because of the difference in technology and weaponry. And it may be that we are making a serious mistake. My feeling is that from once things were pretty much locked into place at the end of World War One, once not only these corporations but the national security elites and also the aristocracies and many of the deposed monarchies all decided to launch on this anti-communist crusade, and when the international or transnational corporate structure was put in place, and it really was the transnational corporations which now dominate life on Earth, were already largely entrenched and pretty much setting the tone in this very time period. It's why I took the time to go into things like the Dawes and the Young Plan and the Bank for International Settlements and who the movers and shakers were in these things that were taking place in the 1920s, and then tried to trace some of these relationships on up through that period in order to show how some of these corporate and economic connections manifested themselves in the political and economic spheres. My feeling is that what's taking place now on the international stage is an outgrowth of that. Germany was never denazified, and what I feel has been happening since the end of World War II is that the powerful fascist elements in the United States have merged with fascist elements, Nazi elements from Germany, and what we literally are seeing is an international fascist hierarchy emerging out of that corporate elite, and I think that the shift that is taking place, and perhaps has probably already taken place, is that instead of Wall Street being the dominant element, now I believe that the German component of this transnational corporate axis is going to prove to be the dominant element. I mean, at this point, German corporations, both the German core corporations and the underground connections with the Bormann apparatus, dominate the world's pharmaceutical industry. They dominate the world's, if you get a vaccine in this country, you vaccinate your kids, you get a shot, that's coming from a Bormann company, coming from the minions of Adolf Hitler. When people drive a luxury car in the United States, what kind of a car are they going to drive? A Porsche, a BMW, a Mercedes-Benz? Ferdinand Porsche was one of Hitler's personal favorites. I mean, he named, not only was the Porsche firm one of Hitler's largest tank producers, behind Adam Opel AG and Ford of Cologne, wholly owned subsidiaries of General Motors and GM, respectively, or GM and Ford, respectively, and then the Henschel Works and the Porsche Works. But just before the Battle of Kursk, for example, the largest armored battle in history, the Nazis introduced a huge self-propelled gun called the Ferdinand, specifically for the Battle of Kursk. And it was named after Ferdinand Porsche, who was one of Hitler's personal favorites. And so I think that what's happening now is that somebody done hoodoo to hoodoo man, as Junior Wells put it in a blues song. I think that, in effect, the Nazi cadre that were supposed to be the bulwark against communism are now calling the shots. One of the things that I introduced in RFA 37 was the Nazi tactic of using anti-communism as a vehicle for struggle. Lenin got back into Imperial Russia, for example, by being shipped into Russia by the Imperial German General Staff. That's how Lenin got in there, to start the Bolshevik Revolution and to knock Russia out of World War One, which he did. They then used fear of communism to curry favor with not only the Allied occupation forces in Germany, who saw to it that the Freikorps and the so-called Black Reichswehr, these underground military units, got all sorts of armament, machine guns, armored cars, all sorts of things they weren't supposed to have left over from World War One, so they could fight the communists. This was a very conscious strategy. They also utilized these same connections, the same fear of communism, to help prevail on the Wall Street elite to join in these cartel connections. And then they utilized it very above board, in a very overt fashion, very successfully, to curry favor from the Western allies. And I believe that during the course of the Cold War, through a combination of corporate penetration, infiltration, and blackmail, I believe that the Germans now have the upper hand. When you consider...